Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Anna Mateo and George Grow. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, astronauts traveling in space meet forms of radiation that are uncommon on Earth. Some of this radiation has been shown to be harmful to human health. It is linked to cancers and heart problems. Yet, a new American study suggests the radiation does not shorten astronauts' lives. Researchers studied nearly 60 years of health records and other data about male astronauts from the United States. They then compared this data to information about a group of men who are in good health, richer than most Americans, and receive good health care, professional athletes. The study found that neither group had higher rates of dying at a young age. In fact, both groups generally live longer than other Americans. Astronauts are usually well-educated, earn more money, and are in better physical condition than the average American. Some earlier research has linked being an astronaut to a lower risk of early death, the researchers noted. The findings were reported in the publication Occupational and Environmental Medicine.
Much of the existing research on mortality rates in astronauts has not yet explored the mental and physical demands of the job. There also has not been a lot of research on whether astronauts show what is known as the healthy worker effect. This effect leads people with employment of any kind to have fewer medical problems than individuals who are unable to work, said Robert Reynolds. He was a member of the study team. Reynolds said, "The challenge has always been to understand if astronauts are as healthy as they would be had they been otherwise comparably employed but had never gone to space at all." He added, "To do this, we needed to find a group that is comparable on several important factors." He said there was no similar study about people who had been in space. His comments were included in an email sent to the Reuters news agency.
The researchers compared mortality for male U.S. astronauts to active or former players from Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association. These men played professionally between 1960 and the middle of 2018. Both the players and astronauts had a lower risk of dying young than the general population, the study found. And there was no difference between the death rates of NBA and MLB players. Astronauts were more likely to die of accidents and less likely to die from heart disease and all other natural causes, the study also found. The results suggest that being in contact with radiation in space might not lead to an early death for astronauts because of heart problems or cancers. In fact, astronauts had a lower rate of death from heart disease than the NBA and MLB players and had cancer death rates similar to those of the athletes.
The study was not designed to prove whether or how space travel may directly affect human health. It also did not examine mortality rates among female astronauts or athletes. Radiation exposure may also have been much lower during early flights to the moon, said researcher Francis Cucinotta. Astronauts usually never smoke, leading to a lower risk of heart disease than the general population, he said. Cucinotta is with the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and was not involved in the study. Diet and physical exercise also set astronauts and professional athletes apart from the rest of the population, said Michael Delp. He is a researcher with Florida State University in Tallahassee. He said a job requiring physical fitness can add to the healthy worker effect. Even for other people, Delp said, remaining or becoming physically active and maintaining a well-balanced diet greatly improves overall health and well-being and can enhance successful aging.
Are you able to take a vacation from your wireless device? A growing number of hotels will help you to find out. Some hotels are offering extras, like food and underwater diving, to people who agree to give up their cell phones for a few hours. Other hotels have phone-free hours in their swimming areas. A few are even banning electronic devices from public places altogether. Hotels that limit cell phone use risk losing publicity on social media services such as Instagram or Facebook. But they say their policies reflect their aim of promoting wellness, fun, and recreation. And they hope that hotel guests will enjoy their experience and return for future visits. Everyone wants to be able to disconnect. They just need a little courage, said Lisa Cecchio. She is chief marketing officer at Wyndham Hotels.
People's inability to disconnect is an increasingly serious issue. Half of cell phone users spend between 3 and 7 hours a day on their mobile devices. That information comes from a 2017 study by Counterpoint Research, a technology advisory service. A separate study by the nonprofit group Common Sense Media found that 69% of parents and 78% of young people said they use their devices at least hourly. Wyndham hotel officials said they had to ask for more chairs for all the people who would sit in them and look at their phones. The hotel company found that the average guest was bringing 3 devices and activating them once every 12 minutes, or about 80 times a day. Last October, Wyndham Grand's 5 U.S. vacation resorts began offering rewards to guests who agreed to put away their phones for a few hours. In exchange for leaving the phone in a soft, protected pouch, guests get good seating by swimming pools, free food, and even chances to win return visits. The devices stay with the guests, but only hotel employees can open the secure pouch. The Associated Press reported last week that 250 people have taken part in the program at Wyndham Resort Hotels in Florida and Texas. Wyndham Grand Resorts offered to cut the cost of a hotel stay by 5% if guests put their phones in a timed lockbox. The hotels provide treats, bedtime books, and instant cameras for adults and children who are not sure what to do with all their newfound free time.
The idea appealed to Matthew Cannata. He heads public relations for the New Britain, Connecticut schools. He worried about the effect of technology on his two young children, and he wants to keep devices out of sight during family meals. Any chance I can get to put the phone away is great. Sometimes people need to be forced to do things to start a thought process and then create a habit, he said. Hotel workers at the Grand Velas Riviera Nayarit in Mexico will remove all electronic devices from your room and replace them with traditional games like chess. Guests at a nearby resort trade in their phones for a bracelet placed around the wrist. The device gives them the right to take part in special activities like diving. They must do at least 4 activities to earn back their phones. A timer in the hotel shows how long each family has remained without their devices.
Miraval is a resort in Arizona owned by Hyatt Hotels Corporation. Miraval's goal is to increase mindfulness and create a sense of calm among their guests. Miraval, which will soon open 2 more resorts in Texas and Massachusetts, bans phone use in most public areas. Guests are told to put their phones into soft cotton bags and leave them on small wooden beds in their rooms. Some resorts want a total ban on electronic devices. Wilderness Resorts, an African tour operator, provides no internet service at many of its camps. A 40-room hotel at the Siwa Oasis in Egypt lets guests have phones in their rooms, but there is no internet service or even electricity.
However, not all vacationers want to be separated from their devices. Phones can serve as cameras, music players, travel guides, and e-readers. They also might be needed in an emergency. Communications manager David Bruins uses 2 phones. He tries not to use his work phone when he is not on the job, but he carries his personal phone everywhere. "I don't think I would like being made to put the thing down," Bruins said. "It feels like that is more about me being told what to do by people I am paying to do something for me." Ayana Resort and Spa in Bali, Indonesia, understands that, so it tries to meet guests halfway. Its winding river pool bans phones for 8 hours every day, but it invites guests to take photographs and publish on social media at other times. I'm Anna Mateo.
I'm George Groh.
Thank you. VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Jackson took office in 1829. He was popular with many voters. They saw him as the symbol of the common man. But Jackson's first term seemed to be mostly a political battle with his vice president, John C. Calhoun. As his presidency went on, another struggle began. This time, it was Jackson against the Bank of the United States. The first Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. But without a central bank, the country's finances had suffered during the War of 1812. So in 1816, Congress provided money to establish the Second Bank of the United States. The bank could provide loans, pay bills, collect taxes, and move money around the country. Congress gave the bank a charter to do business for 20 years. The government owned one-fifth of the bank. A small group of private citizens owned the rest. Lawmakers gave the bank enormous power. The Bank of the United States had $35 million in capital. Some of that money came from the government. Most came from investors. Historian Bray Hammond notes that at the time, the Bank of the United States was the richest corporation in the world. The Bank of the United States also printed the country's paper money, and it was the only bank permitted to have offices across the nation. By making it easy or difficult for businesses to borrow money, the bank's owners could control the economy in almost any part of the United States.
What this means is that you are granting, and Congress did grant, exclusive privileges to the Bank of the United States, which meant exclusive money-making opportunities to its stockholders.
Historian Daniel Feller explains that the Bank of the United States helped the government to do its business effectively and efficiently. But it also helped the people who owned stock in the bank. During Jackson's presidency, a man named Nicholas Biddle led the Bank of the United States. Biddle was an extremely intelligent man. He had completed his studies at the University of Pennsylvania when he was only 13 years old. When he was 18, he was sent to Paris as secretary to the American minister. During America's war with Britain in 1812, Biddle helped establish the Bank of the United States. He became its president when he was only 37 years old. Biddle clearly understood his power as president of the Bank of the United States. In his mind, the government had no right to interfere in any way with the bank's business. President Jackson did not agree, nor was he very friendly toward the bank. Not many people from Western states were. They did not trust the bank's paper money. They wanted to deal in gold and silver. Jackson criticized the bank in each of his yearly messages to Congress. He said the Bank of the United States was dangerous to the liberty of the people. He said the bank could build up or pull down political parties through loans to politicians. Jackson opposed giving the bank a new charter. He proposed that a new bank be formed as part of the Treasury Department. The president urged Congress to consider the future of the bank long before the bank's charter was to end in 1836. Then, if the charter was rejected, the bank could close its business slowly over several years. Changing the banking system slowly, Jackson said, would prevent serious economic problems for the country. But the bank's president wanted to renew the charter early. He made the request in January 1832, 9 months before the next presidential election. Jackson's opponent, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky, was sure that the issue of the bank could win him some votes. Clay argued his case on the floor of the Senate for 3 days. He strongly urged the Senate to renew the bank's charter. He said the country was in the middle of a revolution, not yet a bloody revolution, but things were happening that pointed to a total change of the pure Republican character of the government. Power was being centered in the hands of one man, he said. He meant President Jackson. Clay added that if Congress did not act, the government would fail. Clay then asked the Senate to condemn Jackson, saying he violated the Constitution and the nation's laws. The Senate approved the resolution. The chief opponent to the bank was Senator Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. He objected to the renewal of the charter, he told the Senate, because the bank was too great and powerful and made the rich richer and the poor poorer. The Senate finally voted on the bank's new charter. The vote was 28 for renewal and 20 against. The House voted 3 weeks later. It also approved the charter, 107-85. The lawmakers sent the bill to the White House. President Jackson debated it with members of his cabinet. Some wanted to negotiate a compromise, but Jackson decided to veto the bill in the strongest possible language. On July 10, 1832, Jackson sent a message to Congress explaining his reasoning. Jackson said he did not believe the bank's charter was constitutional. Jackson also spoke of the way the bank moved money from west to east. He said the bank was owned by a small group of rich men, mostly in the east. Some of the owners, he said, were foreigners. Much of the bank's business was done in the West. The money paid by Westerners for loans went into the pockets of the Eastern bankers. Jackson said this was wrong. Then the president spoke of his firm belief in the rights of the common man. It is to be regretted, he said, that the rich and powerful bend the acts of the government to their own purposes. Jackson said that instead, the government should shower its favors, as heaven does its rain, on the high and low alike, on the rich and the poor equally. Jackson's veto of the bank bill may have cost him votes among the wealthy, but it earned him votes among the common people, like farmers and laborers. He easily won re-election in November of 1832. Martin Van Buren became his vice president. Historian Daniel Fellers says Jackson believed his victory meant that Americans supported his policies including the bank veto.
He had a very popular personal image. It's possible he would have been reelected by the same margin or larger anyway. The one thing we can say looking forward is that when later on you had somebody carrying on Jackson's policies absolutely faithfully without Jackson's personal charisma, he proved to be not nearly so popular.
In his second term, Jackson stopped putting federal money into the Bank of the United States. Instead, he put the money into state banks. The bank president, Nicholas Biddle, fought with all his power to keep the bank open. He demanded that borrowers immediately repay their loans. Businesses struggled without the bank's assistance. Workers lost their jobs. Biddle blamed President Jackson for the financial panic. Critics of Jackson's bank policy called him King Andrew I. But as time passed, business people began to see that the Bank of the United States was being much tighter in its money policy than was necessary. They began to feel that it was the bank's president, not Jackson, who was responsible for the serious economic situation in the country. Biddle took no responsibility for the financial crisis. He then made a very bad decision. Biddle asked the governor of Pennsylvania to make a speech supporting the bank. At the same time, Biddle refused to lend the state of Pennsylvania $300,000. The governor was furious. Instead of making a speech supporting the bank, he made one that sharply criticized it. 2 days later, the governor of New York proposed that the state sell $4 or $5 million of stock for loans to help state banks. The New York legislature approved selling even more. Strengthening state banks helped break the power of the Bank of the United States. Nicholas Biddle began to see that the battle was lost. He started making more loans to businesses. The economic panic slowly ended. Jackson's victory over the Bank of the United States was clear. Biddle started to lose the support of many members of Congress. In the House of Representatives, James Polk proposed 4 resolutions about the bank. One said the bank should not get a new charter in 1836. The second resolution said government money should not be deposited in the bank. The third said the government should continue to put its money in state banks. And the fourth proposed an investigation of the bank and the reasons for the economic panic in the country. All 4 of these anti-bank resolutions were approved. One of Biddle's aides described the feelings of bank officials. "This day," he said, "should be ripped from the history of the Republic." He said, "The President of the United States had seized the public treasury, and the representatives of the people had approved it." Jackson won what he himself considered a glorious triumph. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.